If there's one thing that really floats my boat, it's the history of the U.S. space program, especially the part that I grew up in, from when I watched my first broadcast of space flights of the Gemini program in the mid-1960s to the end of the Apollo Moon program in 1972. If you're interested in something, there's probably a YouTube channel for that. And man, oh man, is there a cool one for my passion, Vintage Space with Amy Shearer Tidal. She joins us next on Blue Dot. Nolan, we recently did our live program at the Gateway Science Museum about the lives of Jean and Carolyn Shoemaker, and I shared a story there about how my interest in space began with a childhood disease. Do you remember that?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, I caught the mumps, and I was like laid up. I couldn't go outside and play, but I was really lucky because on our little black and white TV, I got to watch the launch of the early Gemini missions that were the precursors to the moon landings. And I was just hooked and fascinated, and they kept me entertained and got me through a tough time. And so ever since then, I was just fascinated by spaceflight, and it became a lifelong passion. So today, we get to join one of my favorite YouTube content providers, the author of Breaking the Chains of Gravity, the story of spaceflight before NASA. Her Vintage Space channel gives viewers her unique and enthusiastic take on lots of fun and undertold stories about the space program back in the day, when we first began to explore the new frontier of outer space. Amy, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
I really want to know how you first became interested in the history of the space program, because it's unusual, or is it? Maybe it's not, for a young woman to be so fascinated by the story of the space race back in the 50s and 60s. Where did that interest begin for you?
For me, it really started when I first heard about the moon landing when I was 7. And I always feel that I should preface this by saying that I am from Canada, where not everybody and their grandfather works for NASA. So I found out about the moon landing when I was researching for a second grade project on Venus. And there was a 2-page spread on the moon with a little cartoon of 2 astronauts standing on the surface. And I just had that moment of, wait, people walked on the moon? Why was I not informed? And I was just fascinated from that point on, and then had to figure out how they did it, why they did it. So it just became that like weird nerd kid fascination with it. And it just spiraled into whatever this is now.
And what did you do? Like, how did you go about investigating this? Where you started? What kind of sources did you find?
I mean, when I was 7, not to give away my age, but this was in the early 90s, so I don't even think we had the internet at home yet. So it was, you know, Encyclopedia Encarta and Britannica and another one that we had on CD-ROM. It was looking up as many, you know, as much stuff as I could find in encyclopedias and history books, which, again, I had never heard of it, so it's not something that we really had lying around the house much. And then finding any TV programs, movies, anything I could about it. And then once, you know, high school came around and college, and I had things like learned the ability to research and access to the internet, then I could start digging into things that NASA had available, which kind of was the game changer and made things a lot more fun.
One of my favorite things that you do is to confront the moon hoax head on. The notion that the moon landings were faked on a Hollywood set. When did you decide to do that, and what was the impetus for that?
The impetus to do the what I called Conspiracy Month really came because I spent the month of August this past year in Australia, and I didn't have stuff with me to actually be doing videos on the road and stuff, so I had to front load a bunch of things, and I came up with the idea with a friend of mine at Discovery of, you know, we could do something like a theme month. So then it becomes like a fun thing that you don't even have to deal with. And what about conspiracy theories? Because I had this one video from about 3 years ago now about how proof we landed on the moon is in the dust. And it looks at the physics of the dust contrails kicked up in the wake of the lunar rover to show that the physics of that falling dust creates a rooster tail, that it is impossible to happen in atmosphere in Earth gravity. So it could only have happened on the moon. And that video is over 1 million views. People love it and mainly love to hate it. So we thought, well, let's just see what happens if we do an entire month of conspiracy theories. And people loved it and also loved to hate it. So it's been kind of fun. It was fun to dig into different common theories you hear and actually dig into the science behind why it's just insane.
In your videos, you do a lot of asking your audience if they have questions, if they want to make comments. Do you get a lot of your ideas from your viewers?
Sometimes. I mean, you know, depending on the some of the early, one thing you'll find in YouTube generally, I think, is that the earlier comments seem to set the tone for the discussion. So if one of the earlier comments is kind of positive and actually asking about some of the science, then you will see people asking really good questions, which sometimes does tell me like, oh, to me, I wouldn't even think that this would make an interesting video, but, you know, 40 people in this one thread are discussing why they used oxygen after the Apollo 1 fire. I've gone through that history. I didn't really necessarily think it was that interesting, but okay, people are talking about it. Let's go into that. And sometimes people bring up things that I've never even heard of or like saw once, but haven't thought about in years. So it's fun. And I like it too, because not only does it help me come up with ideas to keep the show going, but it also makes sure that I'm actually giving my audience what they want to learn about and what they're interested in, as opposed to just me telling them what they should be interested in that week. So, yeah, it's a nice mix.
Let's leave that behind in the regolith where it belongs now. One of my favorite videos you did was about the markings on the Saturn V moon rocket. When I was growing up, that rocket was something somehow godlike to me, as were the astronauts. And I always thought the striking black and white patterns were so cool. I remember trying to paint them on my model rockets when I was a little kid and botching that really badly. Can you explain, though, they had a purpose, didn't they?
They did. And I should just add that I also failed spectacularly when I painted my own Saturn V rocket to try to have that nice, clean black and white pattern. Only I was in my 20s when I did it, and it still looked pretty bad. The point of the black and white sections on the Saturn V was to help with tracking the rocket as it flew. Because they were actually, if you look, not that you can, but if you were to take the rocket and kind of like slice it down, you know, its up-down axis and like flatten it out, you'd see that it's very regular quarters. So this was a way that they could actually track the rocket rolling. And this was very much a holdover from the 1940s when, and or the 30s even, when von Braun and his crew in Germany was actually developing rockets for the German army, that they would paint them with this scheme to be able to track the roll program and track its movement in the sky and actually make sure that it was doing what it was supposed to be doing and going where it was supposed to be going. So a bit of a holdover, because you don't see it in the Atlas or the I'm just thinking back through, actually. I guess you do see it on the Titan. But yeah, you don't see it in the Atlas, but you do see it in the Redstone, which is, of course, another von Braun rocket. So there's heritage to it, but it's useful heritage and also looks awesome.
I can't get the picture out of my head of a 20-year-old young lady painting a Saturn V model rocket. That's just awesome.
It was fun.
How many of the astronauts have you been able to meet? And who are some of your favorites?
I've been able to meet a fair number of astronauts, which is pretty great. Usually at, you know, signing events where they kind of have to talk to you because you're giving them money for an autograph. I don't think I could rattle off the entire list, but a lot, like upwards of 20, which is insane. I don't even know how many of them are still kicking around, but 20 is a lot of Apollo era astronauts. And then, you know, a handful more shuttle era astronauts. I think one of my favorite people that I've had a chance to speak to in a handful of times, as far as astronauts are concerned, is probably Dick Gordon, the command module pilot of Apollo 12, of course. He is a very interesting character and very much still, I mean, the thing with a lot of these guys, and I'm sure you have met a handful of them, and I'm sure you will have something to add to this astronaut talk in a second here. He's, you know, he may be in his 80s, but he's sort of like mentally and emotionally like 25. And a lot of them are just kind of goofy. And for some reason, I always end up having weird food related questions to ask Dick Gordon, whether it's about the sandwich that a suit tech put in Pete Conrad's leg pocket the day they launched to the moon, or whether it was who stole bacon squares, or whether it was about the tuna incident, which is no one knows about, but I do because I've read the transcript. He knows me at this point as the girl who always asks weird food questions, which I will say is not the worst way for an astronaut to know you. But yeah, once you kind of get to know these guys and they know you for something, they will kind of sit down and chat and have a bit of a more interesting conversation with you, and then just sort of like, oh, hello. Yes, this is what I did. Okay, next. Yeah, Dick Gordon's a fun one. And also, if you put him and Al Warden together on stage and let them riff off each other, they are like the best peanut gallery of all time.
Both command module pilots, too.
And both hilarious. I imagine you've met some pretty interesting astronauts.
Oh, yes. Many over the years. In fact, my kids used to get the biggest kick out of when I was doing a lot of journalism, print journalism. I was working on a story about Apollo 17. And this is back in the day of, you know, old phone recording machines. I would come home from work, which was school. I'm a high school science teacher. And there would be messages on there from, you know, Chris Kraft or Harrison Schmitt or Gene Cernan. And my kids would be like, that's Gene Cernan on there? That's the astronaut that walked? Yep, that's him.
That's awesome.
And we've got a record. Yep, that's him. So that was pretty awesome. My kids like that. But you also like collectible stuff, little models and things. Tell us about some of your cool stuff that you have.
I have a lot of really odd stuff. I have a collection of space toys. Not all of them vintage. Some of them vintage reproduction. My favorite ones are the plastic ones that I can carry around in my purse at parties. Because then when you meet somebody and you describe what you do and you pull out the Apollo module and talk about it, and then you want to follow up for like a work opportunity or an interview or whatever, they remember that you were the weird kid with the space toy in her purse. So that's really fun. I also have a stunning wall of astronaut autographs that I actually recently put into one giant collection. It's quite impressive. I've got a lot of vintage books and magazines from the 60s, newspaper clippings. I mean, I get some really amazing fans who will send me things that they collected when they were kids watching the Apollo program happen. And they, you know, they'll email me and say, I have this and I don't know what to do with it, but you'll appreciate it, won't you? So I have like one of the original 7 inches of the, I don't even have a record player, but I have records of the, original audio recording from Apollo 11 that was mm-hmm. released to the public as a 7-inch. I didn't even know that was a thing that happened until I was sifting through this pile someone sent me once, and there's a 7-inch record in there. All kinds of weird stuff, yeah.
And
I've even got vintage whiskey decanters shaped like astronauts.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you have a cat.
I do have a cat.
And his name is Pete.
His name is actually Pete Conrad. He has his own surname.
Your cat is named after the commander of Apollo 12.
Yes.
Who is probably, to me, the coolest and funniest of all the astronauts.
Yeah, I don't know. Did you ever have a chance to meet him?
I never had the chance to meet. He passed away before I had the chance. But in all my conversations with people that were friends of his, they just said he was just the biggest crack up in the world to be with.
Yeah, I was quite young when he died. There's no way did I have the clout to, you know, interview him for anything, because it would have been like a middle school newspaper at the time, which my middle school didn't even have. So, I never met Pete Conrad, but you asked earlier, sort of how I got into kind of digging into the minutia of Apollo as opposed to just sort of the superficial story. A lot of it was also reading astronaut biographies, because that made it human and accessible for somebody who was, you know, 10, 11, 12, and not necessarily the best at hard science. And Pete Conrad's biography, written by his wife, is just jumped out to me as like the funnest story, and made me want to know more about him and his mission and his crew more than any other astronaut biography did. So I kind of latched on to Pete Conrad and the whole Apollo 12 crew as like my jumping off point to make Apollo accessible, because it was human. They made it human for somebody who's an arts kid. So that's why I've always really kind of loved the bond that they had, at least the way that they talk about it, and that it's been recorded. And you can even hear it when you read the transcript, you can see that they were closer than most crews. I named my cat after Pete Conrad. And every time I take him to the vet or a new vet and I say, he's Pete Conrad, what's your last name? Title. why does your cat have his own surname? It's like, it's all right. Don't worry about it. Just write down Pete Conrad on the card.
That's hilarious. And maybe Pete is really that cat now.
Maybe. I did actually have the hilarious conversation. I met Nancy Conrad just by phone a few months ago. We were introduced through a mutual friend. And she's awesome. She's lovely. One day I hope to meet her in person. But I sort of awkwardly, halfway through the call, Pete was sitting on my desk with his face in my face. And I sort of told her, you know, I hope this doesn't sound really weird or creepy, but I am currently being stared down by a cat who is named Pete Conrad. And she sort of pauses and says, that is awesome.
Oh,
that's, and I was like, oh, good. Yeah, paying homage to your late husband, who made me love space in a way that I didn't think I could, because, yeah, made it human.
For those who don't know, he passed away in a motorcycle accident. Tragically, way too young. And one of my favorite episodes of From the Earth to the Moon, I think the series from HBO, is the Apollo 12 story.
Yeah, I think that's most people's favorite episode. It's the most fun. It's for sure the most fun. And it really does, that episode, I think, does a great job of capturing the kind of playfulness of it and the fact that when you get right down to it, these were just a bunch of hotshot pilots going on a really awesome road trip, if you will, together. I mean, it's just, you kind of get that impression of like, all right, pile on in, let's just do this thing.
You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with YouTube's vintage space enthusiast, Amy Shiratitel. And we're back, continuing our conversation with Amy Shiratitel about her passion for vintage space, the early times in the American space program. Let's talk a little bit about movies, documentaries, Hollywood. What are some of your favorites and why?
In terms of space movies, I assume.
Yeah, anything having to do with, you know, actual space flight.
Actual space. I mean, I always will go back to Apollo 13. And more than anything, because it's so well written. Of all the space movies, I feel like space movies fall into the problem of needing so much explanatory dialogue to tell you that things are scary and that things are hard and that there's rockets and rockets explode. It's like Apollo 13 manages to show you the intensity of the drama and show you what was going on with the crew without having to force feed it to you. And the subtlety of the dialogue, the subtlety of the technical details, that aren't even said, that are just shown, but shown in a way that when you know what's going on, you see the details and you get it. But if you don't, if you're not, you know, you haven't read the transcript and you don't know the mission intimately, it doesn't take away from it. It doesn't make you feel like you're missing something. So that's always the movie that I go to as a excellent space movie. And that's about it. I mean, the Wright stuff is also great in its way. Yeah, that's kind of it. I'm like, much to the chagrin of everybody that I know, I'm not a big sci-fi fan. So,
well, that's not real.
Yeah.
You know, you're interested in real stuff.
I always say that I prefer real space to fake space. So like, sure. It took me 2 years to see Interstellar, I think. I'm not a huge Matthew McConaughey fan. So well, like, I
just
I
found that film
it.
To be depressing.
It lost me at the bookshelf dimension too. I was watching it with my parents. I was like, okay, this is fine. It's sci-fi. I can see what's going on. I see how people like it. And then he lands in the bookshelf and I think it was, you know, very quiet and has my parents. And I think I just yelled out, oh, come on.
I preferred The Martian, if you're going to go down that route.
I did like The Martian, but I thought, again, there was, you know, that scene when they're deciding whether or not they should swing around the Earth and go right back to Mars to pick him up, and they have that conversation where, what's her name? The redheaded commander. I forget the actress's name, but she's like, you know, if we mess up this rendezvous, we die. If we don't do this right, we die.
Yeah.
I was sort of sitting there thinking like...
Real astronauts don't say that.
Yeah, I was sitting there thinking like... How is it that Apollo 13, they never said anything about the danger, but I was way more worried watching that movie than I was watching this.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, that's what I mean when I think of explanatory dialogue and why there's not a lot of space movies that I love.
One thing I remember Jim McDivitt telling me about The Right Stuff is he said they got the flavor of Edwards Air Force Base exactly right. He said, you know, aside from events and did this happen or that, he said the flavor of it is spot on.
Yeah, that's I've heard a lot of astronauts say that even if it's kind of an artistic what's the word I'm looking for, like
license.
An artistic view, that's the word, thank you. like an artistic license view of the Mercury program, it very much does capture the spirit of it from everything else that I've read and all the movies I've seen in terms of like little documentary bits and pieces from archive footage, that it's very much that like group of ragtag engineers and hotshot pilots just cobbling things together and making it work and kind of off on their own. And, you know, as Tom Wolfe writes so many times, drinking and driving and driving and flying.
Yeah.
And that was it. It really does give you a flavor of what that era was like from the perspective, I think, of those guys.
You find all kinds of fascinating little tidbits about the space program, and I thought it'd be kind of cool for you to share one of them with us. I was watching one of the videos recently about, I think it's Dick Gordon is the picture that you've got an astronaut that looks like a pirate. You want to explain that one to us?
It's John Young.
Oh, it's John Young.
Actually,
okay.
Yeah, it's yeah. This is one of those things that I have seen and never really thought too much about. But a viewer came to a talk I gave in Seattle a couple weeks ago and asked me about it. And he emailed me a clip of the raw footage from Apollo 10 where John Young is wearing an eye patch. And he wanted to know why. So I looked into it. And it was, one of those just tiny little details that you don't really think about. The eye patch was needed because... the way the guidance computer worked, there were programs in the computer that would take. Oh my God, this is one of those things that I'm less good at explaining off the top of my head than when I'm writing it out. Okay, so the Apollo guidance system was inertial in that the spacecraft held its orientation on its trajectory by three gyros spinning at opposite angles, right? Mm-hmm. And every once in a while, if it started to drift or to make sure that it wasn't drifting, the computer could do a stellar alignment. So it would sight a star and measure where the star should be and where it really was. And the offset between those two points is how much the spacecraft drifted. And then it could correct its orientation to make sure that everything was exactly where it should be or heading where it should be. Oriented, rather, I should say, not heading, because like you're heading to the moon no matter what with all that velocity. So then there was the backup of the astronaut. The command module pilot would also serve as navigator and do a manual star sighting to double check with the computer. And to do this, because things in space can be bright, like the moon and the sun and the Earth, and even just the sunlight bouncing off the spacecraft, they would preserve night vision in one eye so they'd be able to actually see the distant stars to be able to sight that one star. So the eye patch, just like pirates would use it to maintain night vision to go below decks, the astronauts would wear eye patches to have night vision in that one eye when they were doing star sightings and then switch it to the other eye so they wouldn't have to do it with one eye closed. They could do it with both eyes open, which feels more natural to your face holes, and sight without losing their ability to see the star.
Wow. And yeah, it just looks so cool to see them with the eye patch on. You're thinking, our Jimbo, yep. We're headed to the moon.
Yeah.
Lastly, before we run out of time here, if there was one video you'd like to recommend for somebody who'd like to visit your site, which is Vintage Space on YouTube, which one would you point them towards?
I know I should always have something ready for this, but I never do. I never know which one I like best. I think one of my current favorites is probably a few months old at this point, but it's a video about why a rocket has to roll when it's going to the moon. or when it's going into orbit. Because this was one of those ones that I had to call in the big guns in the form of a friend of mine who wrote an amazing book about called How Apollo Flew to the Moon. And this is one of the first sort of easy, I mean, I want to say like quote unquote easy physics lessons I gave on like the orientation of the launch pad versus the orientation of the plane, the orbital plane of the moon around the Earth versus orbit based on where you're actually leaving the Earth from. There were a lot of things happening in that video. And I got the sign off from the friend who helped me that I actually did an okay job. And I did it with a little hairspray tube covered in paper to be a rocket because it was so hard to demonstrate. But that was one of those ones that was so satisfying to get it right. And it's done fairly well. So yeah, the video is called Why Does a Rocket Need to Roll Going into Orbit? And it was one of the interesting things that I never really thought about because people asked all the time. And I did wonder, like, you see, the rocket is a tube. And all it needs to do is pitch over to go into orbit. So why do they have a roll program? What's the point? What's the point of spinning around its axis before it pitches over? It should all just be a tube. So it turns out there's a lot to that simple roll program.
You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. We're talking to Amy Shira Teitel, space flight journalist, author, and host of Vintage Space on YouTube. Lastly, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about your book. You wrote a book called Breaking the Chains, and it's a look at the early history of the space program before really NASA began. And what was your purpose in writing that?
Yeah. My purpose for writing Breaking the Chains of Gravity was really a labor of love more than anything else. As a kid kind of getting into Apollo on my own, the narrative that the public sees and that people remember and kind of, you know, disseminate to later generations, myself being of said later generation, is that very, you know, there is NASA and everything's lovely. And then the Soviets go up and we choose to go to the moon. And that is obviously what had to happen. But it gives the impression that NASA was created in a vacuum and that spaceflight is really easy because NASA was just a thing that magically appeared one day and then suddenly was able to go to the moon. And the more you dig into the story, the more you realize that that's not true, that NASA was not created in a vacuum, that NASA was created from all of these existing parts in the country, and that it was building off of almost 50 years of research and development into things like rocketry and human factors and even just bureaucracy of managing a program that large. And that's the stuff that nobody knows. And I thought it was worth writing that story for a popular audience, for an audience that isn't, you know, hasn't been sort of, you know, inducted into the space fraternity or whatever, if you will. Because ultimately, it'll give you a better appreciation of just how hard space is and how much NASA had to go through to become a thing that could exist. To really say that space isn't easy, that it's a little bit insane that we got to the moon in 10 years, but we also were building off of a lot of knowledge. So when you look at space now and think, why aren't we further away? Well, understanding the roots of spaceflight and the roots of how hard it was to get off the ground in the first place and what kind of had to happen to get that first step into space makes you appreciate that it's not just a matter of lighting a big rocket and pushing the go button. There's a lot more to it, and appreciating how hard people had to work to establish this stuff makes you appreciate how hard people are still working to do what seems routine today, because it's anything but routine.
Amy Shira Teitel is the author of Breaking the Chains of Gravity, The Story of Spaceflight Before NASA, and the star producer of Vintage Space on YouTube. You can follow her on Twitter at Amy Shira Teitel. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, and you can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org. Thanks to co-producer and all-around great guy, Nolan Ford. Follow us on Twitter at nsprnews and me at Dave Shlom. And as always, I remind you that when viewed from the window of your Apollo command module, we all live on a pale blue dot.